Hello, listeners. My name is Donna Kuo, and I am a board-certified psychiatric and family nurse practitioner. Welcome to the Brighten Up podcast, where we pull up the shades and shine the light on mental health topics both affecting and improving the lives of families. We are extremely privileged to welcome today's guest, Dr. Stacy Greeter, and we will be focusing on our discussion on understanding undiagnosed autism and neurodiversity in adult females. Dr. Greeter has a very impressive background. She is board certified in both child, adolescent, and adult psychiatry. She graduated summa cum laude from Duke University, where she was inducted into the Phi Beta Kappa Honor Society and received her Doctor of Medicine degree from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. During her undergraduate and medical training, Dr. Greeter conducted extensive clinical research funded by the Howard Hughes Medical Institute on autism and obsessive compulsive disorder. She completed her adult studies and her child and adolescent subspecialty training at Northwestern University in Chicago, where she trained with nationally and internationally renowned psychiatrists. She is currently self-employed at her private practice in Sarasota, Florida, where she enjoys helping those with complex mental illness and unique family systems, utilizing her particular expertise in treating trauma-related disorders, ADHD, depression, PTSD, autism, anxiety disorders, schizophrenia, and bipolar disorder. Dr. Greeter is passionate about raising the bar for mental health awareness and treatment, and she exhibits this by her willingness to educate and train colleagues in diverse specialties about common mental health disorders and treatment plans in order to improve access for patients. Thank you again for coming in today, Dr. Greeter. So,
thanks, Donna.
For our listeners, just to share a little bit of a background on what the month of April means in regard to autism, April is designated as Autism Acceptance Month. Time for raising awareness about autism spectrum disorder, promoting acceptance, understanding, and inclusion of individuals living with autism, as well as advocating for support and resources for those affected. Throughout the month, various events, campaigns, and initiatives are organized globally to educate the public and to celebrate diversity and strengths of individuals living on the autism spectrum. We'll get started. It has been often said that the strength of a psychiatrist is not just in their medical knowledge, but in their ability to connect with their patients on a human-to-human level, mm-hmm. having that empathy and ability to provide support and hope. So can you tell us a little bit about what attracted you to the field of psychiatry, a little bit more about yourself, and what prompted you to pursue this career?
Okay, so how I got into psychiatry. My interest in psychiatry began at a very young age, as I have always been very curious about people and other people's minds. I feel like it is the one place where I get so much intellectual stimulation and also so much emotional connection and depth. That I feel extremely grateful to be a psychiatrist. And I don't think there's any other profession that you can do that will simultaneously grow you as much while you help other people grow. So it's a very nice side benefit. I really am grateful to be a psychiatrist. It's a privilege.
I would have to agree. I use that word a lot as a practicing psychiatric nurse practitioner. It's a privilege mm-hmm. to be invited into the living room of your patients' minds and be able to connect on that level. It's a special opportunity for sure.
Mm-hmm. To be allowed to bear witness to the most intimate, vulnerable, and painful things in someone else's life is both challenging and special.
Absolutely. And I think just as we go through life and we gain skills and experiences, I think that lends itself to sharing that with patients, you know, as a practicing mm-hmm. clinician, whether in mental health overall. So it's very neat. Shifting our discussion now on the topic and focusing on neurodiversity mm-hmm. and autism diagnosis identified later in life, particularly for adult females, I'd like to share just, you know, an interesting statistic to get your feedback. Traditionally, autism was thought to be predominantly seen in boys, with males being 4 times more likely to be diagnosed with autism than girls. And more recently, experts are realizing that almost as many females as males actually have autism. But recent research shows that nearly 80% of autistic females are undiagnosed as of age 18. Why do you think this is? And how are the childhood signs and symptoms different to allow females to fly under the radar?
I mean, that's a great question, Donna. And I think we're still figuring it out. I think one of the primary issues is that when girls are autistic, they tend to display less of external behaviors, but experience even more internal distress. It's just not seen on the outside. So they may be more likely to approach and make eye contact, but still experience distress in social situations, needing to really analyze what's going on. We just don't see everything that's going on internally. I mean, some other reasons are that some of our stereotypes of what autism looks like, which are based on, you know, criteria in the DSM-5 is based on studies of boys primarily. So it doesn't fit a girl's presentation as well, since it wasn't based on their presentation. The special interests that girls have tend to be more appropriate versus boys. It might be like train tables, girls it could be ponies, but the intensity of that interest is autistic. While boys tend to what we call externalize behaviors, like have a big giant tantrum meltdown, girls tend to hide distress. And this is a general rule, not for everyone. Hide distress and mask. That means to look more neurotypical on the outside and keep that distress inward.
And that can get heavy, I can imagine, you know,
yes.
Processing childhood.
Studies actually show that autistic females are more likely than autistic males to have accompanying anxiety and depression.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Because of
so
the
may, they
social
may look less autistic on the surface, but they experience more internal distress. There's also studies show that autistic people who appear more neurotypical or can mask better and don't have intellectual disability experience greater discrimination and greater bullying, because it's assumed that the child is willfully not performing or not doing what you want them to do because you don't see that they are struggling.
Okay.
Yeah. So we tend to be more forgiving when we can see that someone is autistic.
You can see a rambunctious boy, but a girl outwardly looks like she's doing just fine and coping without those hyperactive behaviors. Meanwhile, there can be just that internal push and pull and trying to navigate childhood and adolescence and learn how you think and how your brain works.
Yeah, I also think that we're less forgiving of people who look less autistic.
Yes.
When they say the wrong thing or offend someone by accident or don't know the appropriate bonds to someone's expression of emotions.
That's true. You could be categorized as rude or blunt or not caring or disconnected, you know, just without really that person making those assumptions, really understanding the differences, neurodiversity, differences in brain function.
So I try to say that not knowing the appropriate social response is different than not caring about someone else.
Absolutely.
And usually the misinterpretation is someone doesn't care.
Misinterpretation of love language or caring language.
Misinterpretation of how autistic people communicate.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. I would also note that as a society, our traditional gender roles, we expect men versus women to engage differently when it comes to communication and expression of emotions and response to emotions. And generally speaking, autistic men fit better the expected gender role of a man, and autistic women don't fit as well the expected gender role of a woman. So that can be a big struggle too, that autistic women experience.
That makes sense. Yes. Men are...
They're called too assertive or too sensitive or et cetera.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Whereas men, you know, it's okay if they want to kind of go into a cave or say something more bluntly. And, you know, we've gotten better, but we're not quite there yet. And then in general, having autism or not, but then adding that on, you know, that adds definitely an added layer of difficulty with acceptance.
Yes.
For sure. I think just working in this field and talking with a lot of colleagues and experiencing this myself, that I'm a true believer that very often personal struggles and adversity breeds strength to help others that you can draw from throughout your life with people you encounter. Can you share with the audience a little bit more about your personal journey and experience with identifying your own neurodiversity and autism diagnosis later in life, I should say, and how that came to be and how that has been and continues to be helpful for and validating for you and your patients?
So I was diagnosed with ADHD from a very young age. That was pretty obvious because my hyperactivity and inattention and disorganization was in people's faces, right? And causing them problems. Whereas my autistic traits were not causing other people problems, so they were not noticed. And also I was extremely social and not fitting the stereotypical model. But I was social, wanting to ask my teachers questions at recess, not play with other kids, right? My social was all about like learning and connecting and sharing information and engaging in my special interest. So I had no idea I was autistic, even as a psychiatrist, because in my residency and fellowship training, I was trained to that autism was caused by a lack of theory of mind. Theory of mind is a fancy way of saying your ability to perceive what is going on in another person's mind and understand a perspective that is different from your own. And so I would think, oh, well, I have intense empathy and I feel other people's feelings intensely. And I'm constantly thinking about what's going on in other people's minds. It's my passion as a psychiatrist. So I can't be autistic, right? And that's one of the, I think, most detrimental myths about autism is a lack of theory of mind. If you look up Milton's double empathy problem, we actually find that autistic people are better at understanding what is going on in another autistic person's mind than neurotypical people are. So what was previously considered a lack of empathy is now understood as a misunderstanding between different neurotypes. Some autistic people struggle with perceiving their own emotions. We call it alexithymia, sort of like color blindness for your feeling states. Then, because they're not picking up on their own emotions, they don't have as much fine detail. It's like blurry. Does that make sense? Fine detail for different emotional states. It can be hard for them to pick that up in others. That is more common in males with autism than females with autism, who are more likely to have an intense experience of others' emotions called hyperempathy, where you experience others' feelings as if they are your own. So the presentation is broad. While it is harder for autistic people to intuitively understand what neurotypicals are trying to communicate than it is for them to understand what an autistic person is trying to communicate, there is no evidence that they lack empathy or theory of mind. So anyways.
Of course not. They just really have a deeper dive, I think, a connection. The sensitivity, it's almost like they're more exposed in their mind.
Some are. I think it varies, right?
Yes.
So that myth was caused by using what we call a neurotypical lens, looking at behaviors. And it's very important that we explore a child or adult's internal experience, not just the behaviors we see on the surface. So I was diagnosed, I like to do a deep dive on a particular area in psychiatry, because psychiatry is my autistic special interest. And I'll explain what that means in a minute. And so I was making a long presentation, a Harry Potter themed presentation, because my other special interest is fantasy, on autism. So while I was reading articles and updating myself in preparation for my presentation, I realized that it all sounded like me. It was very weird. I was like, did someone write a book about me? Has someone been spying on me? What's going on? All these things I thought was idiosyncratic. I was like, oh, that fits autism. And a friend of mine, a good friend of mine, Charnel Widnall, who is an also autistic therapist, was like, yeah, Stacey, I think you're autistic. I encouraged me to go, you know, get assessed. And I had a psychological assessment done. I made my husband attend to make sure that he agreed with what I was reporting, because I wanted an accurate report. And so I got my diagnosis officially. It was like, I think it was like June of 2023, less than a year ago.
Okay.
And you also asked me, there's a lot embedded in that question.
Yes, I know.
You also asked me about how that has served me. First of all, I am much better at understanding my autistic patients and diagnosing them. And I understand why I connect so well. I understand the lens through which I view my world better, which helps me to recognize the different lenses that other people view the world. Self-understanding is just the first key step to self-compassion, acceptance, and effective self-care. So I recognize now that engaging in my special interests are areas that autistic people get emotion regulation, sustenance, and renewal from focusing on and learning about. So yeah, psychiatry for me. And recognizing that helps me to be fulfilled. It helps me in my relationship with my husband, where I understand, you know, my sensory system better, that if the lighting is bothering me, I shouldn't just say, oh, you know, you should just get used to it. You should know that I need to address that so that my brain can function optimally and be available to do good things in the world. So instead of dismissing some things, I know better to take those cues seriously to optimize my functioning.
Absolutely. I get that. Optimize functioning, mm-hmm. and relationships.
Yes.
Anticipating, this is how I relax. This is how my brain goes into that restful, mm-hmm. state.
I think that's great for all of us.
Absolutely.
I mean, and honestly, the funnest part was like telling my patients that I'm autistic, who are autistic, and especially kids, you know, because we're such a powerful role model as physicians for little kids.
Absolutely. Yes. 100%.
To instill hope in the sense that they're not alone with this new diagnosis. So I feel really grateful to be able to share that information.
And I think not only not alone, but also appreciating and having that self-compassion, mm-hmm. and seeing the sky's the limit, my physician with these impressive credentials and who can, mm-hmm. relate to me, and celebrating your mind and your life experience and having that acceptance early on in life, I think just really cuts through so many weeds of just shame and holding a big bat to yourself, and mm-hmm. having that awareness and incorporating those speed bumps for anybody, you know, however your brain might work, to have the best relationships and live your best life.
Mm-hmm. I think it's very important that we not try to sanitize the pain and suffering that comes with being autistic. And I'll explain what the neurodiversity affirming approach is, because it fits in here well, I think. But the neurodiversity affirming approach also allows gratefulness for the strengths of being autistic and holds space for that. So So neurodiversity affirming means recognition that our society benefits from multiple different neurotypes in various ways. That we, for example, need autistic people to be pattern seekers and hyper-focus on an area, their special interest in becoming an expert, and ADHDers to be explorers and find novel things and go-getters. And we need neurotypical people, and we need dyslexic people. So whereas the traditional deficit-based medical model of care, the most common way or, quote, normal way is the correct way to be, and the goal is for the person to be as close an approximation as that common normal way to be as possible. In neurodiversity-affirming care, the goal is for that person to be as authentic and functional and fulfilled as possible. So that is the difference.
And it benefits society as a whole if we really exemplify strengths. I mean, we all have different gifts and strengths and ways that we contribute to society. And how great would it be in school systems when you're celebrating neurodiversity affirming classrooms or programs to say, hey, this is a special superpower you have. Maybe you're an outside-of-the-box thinker with ADD. These, you know, might be some career paths or things that you would really work great with. These might be some struggles, but really it's all in the presentation, starting that positive affirmation at a younger age.
I think, even
having special colleges or programs. And as somebody,
as somebody that has ADHD,
I can relate because
I wouldn't call it a superpower, but I will say that it's important to cultivate strengths as well as accommodating and supporting vulnerabilities and to have that balanced approach. You know, 10% or less of autistic people have intellectual disability. The vast majority of autistic people are not intellectually disabled. I do want to honor the value of autistic people who don't have a so-called superpower, you know what I mean, to offer society that's productive in a capitalist way.
Sure.
If that makes sense.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm just throwing that out there. I am very lucky to be extremely intelligent and have a special interest that helps the world and also can be a career for me, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'm very, very lucky and fortunate as an autistic person. I think that many autistic people find that, but not all autistic people, I guess, have the opportunity in society to make their special interest something that society really values.
Right.
I'm lucky.
Right. Yes.
Society really values extremely good psychiatric treatment, so I'm lucky.
Absolutely. I get that. Whereas, you know, certain things like history or train obsessions, like you were mentioning, there's not always a place for that.
Exactly.
But it would be nice to have more communities or more acceptance, more appreciation for allowing everybody in our society to explore that and be respected for whatever their special interest is, even if it's not, you know, something that they could be paid for necessarily, or
I know
a huge waiting list. Mm-hmm. I understand that. I mean, my nephew is 13 now and moderately autistic, a whiz at math, and is in middle school. But his attention to detail just never ceases to like surprise me, and just his ability to retain knowledge and statistics and facts and people's personal stories, and he's very thoughtful to go back and, you know, ask somebody he saw hasn't seen in 5 years, hey, how is your son doing, and knows all of the details about that. So it's quite remarkable.
Yeah
for sure.
And I agree with you. I think our formal educational system is very painful for people who don't fit the mold.
Right. I think as a society, neurotypical people, or, you know, we all have to get a little bit comfortable being uncomfortable by embracing each other's differences mm-hmm. and lifestyles and pretty much everything. What percentage of our population can be diagnosed as being neurodivergent?
Yeah. I actually don't know the numbers off the top of my head.
Okay. I read a study about that was done 5 years ago. It was about 20% on some level. Mm-hmm. But
and even it's we're still figuring out what counts as neurodivergent. You know, like it's accepted pretty widely, autism, ADHD, and dyslexia. And now it's like, well, is OCD neurodivergence, right? You know what I mean?
Yes.
There's complexity even in who belongs in the category called neurodivergent. We're figuring it out.
This story is still being written.
Yes.
And hopefully as that comes yes. out, you know, there'll be more and more acceptance and provisions to
understanding. I hope.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So this is a relatively new diagnosis. And for our listeners, mm-hmm. what would you say adult women who are living with autism encounter in regard to social interactions, relationships, professional settings? What are some of the challenges that they may face?
I think that miscommunication is extremely risky and painful. And adult autistic women are more vulnerable to that, more vulnerable to not understanding the context-based communication and taking things literally and directly, and then vulnerable to being labeled as not caring about something that they simply didn't understand, or when they are very direct in their communication style, being labeled overly assertive or rude, and when not knowing exactly the socially appropriate way to respond, also being labeled as not caring. So that's really tough. I think that socially it's tough. A lot of us find other neurodivergent people to connect with, and it is pretty beautiful and like, zing, I connect to you. It's great, you know, and it's natural. It's harder for autistic people to feign interest when they're not interested in something someone's talking about. And with our intense, we call it monotropic attention style, which basically means that something that catches our interest sucks us in very deeply. We may be prone to monologuing about something we're really interested in beyond the point of someone else's interest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then really small talk that is basically language being used to solidify a social relationship that doesn't really have meaning in and of itself. You know, how are you? Great. It doesn't matter if you're great or not. You just say great, right? That's
just
the expected
standard nicety.
You know what I'm saying, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That can be really, really challenging because in autistic communication, language, it focuses on clarity of information. Clarity of sharing information to others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I used to actually want to do academic medicine and work at an academic institution, and I love teaching. So that's why, you know, and I did some research back in the day. But I am in private practice instead because the social hierarchy and politics mm-hmm. that you're supposed to know how to do things, but it's not really told how you behave politically. And the expectation is to treat people with different deference based on their social standing in
yes.
the hierarchy.
Yep.
That is very challenging for a lot of autistic people, for me in particular. And again, I'm speaking to my personal story here that doesn't necessarily, of course, doesn't apply to all autistics. But I will say for me personally, I don't mask. It's just too hard for me. And I will relate to like the waitress at my table serving me the same way as like, you know, an attending who, and so, you know, just with kind of the same language choice and demeanor. And my patients love it because they're like, wow, I feel just so, you know, comfortable and open, and there's not this power dynamic going on. But it doesn't work in social hierarchies well at all. So that's a challenge, I think, when autistic people are expected to try to function within a social hierarchy and the expectations are not laid out explicitly. There's all these implicit expectations. It was hard.
We could all benefit from more humility, I think, in our society.
And I think more explicit expectations are great for neurotypicals too, honestly. And we're self-directed learners. Residency and fellowship were very challenging. A lot of autistic doctors don't make it through or have a delayed graduation or get burned out. And I'm really grateful that I did make it out so I can learn now.
Sure.
In my own self-directed way and really connect to mentors who are the right fit for me and have office staff who I can communicate my needs to, let them know, like, hey, if you say something to me and you think I'm ignoring you, maybe I didn't get it. Maybe try more explicit.
Right.
And that giving people that heads up of what to expect from me and how to communicate with me really helps.
Yes.
I'm grateful. I work with people who, when there's a miscommunication, we talk through it very openly. And my office likes the culture of open, direct, non-hierarchical communication.
Definitely. You're all there serving you know, a common cause, the patients, and understanding. I think having outings and team bonding and in all settings where people work together are so beneficial and helpful with just learning a little bit about how you all operate and what to expect, especially in your situation as the leader of your practice and a psychiatrist and having so many tasks on a day-to-day level.
But they can tell me things even though I'm the leader. For example, I'll give you an example. I asked in our team meeting if I would be an asset or a liability during a particular meeting with our landlord about an issue. And my team said I would be a liability and I should not go.
Okay.
And so I appreciate that they recognize my strengths and my vulnerabilities and that can communicate them directly to me.
They've got your back.
Yes, they've got my back. And not just that, but like, yes, I'm technically, I am the boss. I mean, yeah, I'm the boss, but they can give me very open, loving and accepting feedback that I don't think people usually give their bosses in other more hierarchical work cultures.
And I think that they're missing
out. We all benefit from it.
Most definitely. I think the best leaders realize they acknowledge, self-acknowledge what their strengths, what their weaknesses are, and then they surround themselves with a team to help them leverage that. And I think it's the person that thinks they know everything and, you know, will nix whoever has an opinion or they don't agree with, you know, that can get kind of dangerous. But I'm happy to hear that that's been instilled in your work culture and has been so beneficial.
Yeah, because I'm in private practice, I can create the work culture that works for me and for us.
And
I value that. And I couldn't do that if I were at an academic institution.
Hopefully that will, with more acceptance and understanding, hopefully that will change because even though you're not formally in a academic building, you are very much an educator. I did watch your podcast video describing, you know, Harry Potter in relation to autism. I mean, it was exemplary. It was fantastic.
Oh, well, thank you.
I learned so much and found you so relatable and understandable. So it was excellent.
Well,
so.
Thank you. I've created teaching opportunities for me, even though I'm not at an institution, to present at conferences. And I have medical students rotate with me, and I have family medicine residents rotate with me. And I run a mental health professionals book club discussion once a month. So I create all these pockets of teaching and learning and intellectual discourse about psychiatry, because I thrive on that. And I'm grateful that I have the independence to be able to do those things.
Sure. Yes. Sign me up for the book club.
Yeah, sure.
I like book clubs. That would definitely be one I would be interested in.
Yes. We're reading, let's see, Get Out of Your Mind and Into Your Life, Acceptance and Commitment Therapy by Stephen Hayes for this month.
Okay. I will pick it up later this afternoon. Excellent. How has your husband been, you know, as, I'll just ask, you know, as an aside question.
Sure.
How is your relationship with him in, other than, you know, maybe anticipating creating, you know, peaceful environments and things like that. But how has your relationship shifted since you've had this
diagnosis? I mean, I think I think that, you know, kudos to my husband, because he has always been extremely loving, and I would say a person who celebrates my idiosyncrasies. And a big part of my healing journey has been to try to, you know, celebrate myself more. And he's been a part of that for sure. I think in terms of really understanding the impact that hunger, changes in routine have on me, it changed practically how we're going to travel in the future. To make sure that we anticipate how the change in routine and the airport and the travel and the stimulation, all the things impact me, and plan around that.
Sure.
So that, you know, I can avoid having a meltdown as soon as we arrive, when he's planning on, like, going all around a new city.
Right.
How you... And then balancing that, like that there's opportunity for me to take time to rest and recharge while he goes running around a new city for a day or two, for example. So I think that's just a practical example of how understanding my being autistic can help us do something that works better, as opposed to trying to do the same thing, like...
Yes, and butting
heads. And it not working out, right?
Right. Saves a lot of just disputes and uncomfortable interactions, and just respecting, you know, those differences and having that time to decompress.
And it's about a joint accommodation. So I think that's important. It's not about the autistic person accommodating the neurotypical person, or the neurotypical person accommodating the autistic person. It's a bending in the middle. How do we both get our needs met?
Compromise.
Yes. He needs, ironically, you mentioned rest. He needs a lot more rest than I do, and rest differently.
Okay.
Like, you know, so my rest might look like a lot of reading of psychiatry, listening to psychiatry podcasts, going to the gym, you know, making a new presentation. And his might look like watching TV. And then for me, watching TV, I'm like, no, I don't feel rested. I can't sit here. I need to get up and be somewhere else. So I think recognizing how that's different for us, so that we can more intentionally and make a better plan about how we both get our needs met.
And think of joint activities simultaneously, where you can both have a good quality time experience together.
Yes.
How long have you been married?
I think 3 years, 3 or 4 years now.
He's
my second husband. Yeah.
Okay. It's definitely a game of compromise. Well, it's like a fine wine. You know, it gets better, I think, as you develop ways to respect and honor each other and give each other the space you need.
Yeah, but I mean, step one, I think, is recognizing what you need.
Right.
I mean, I don't even think that compromise... I don't think compromise is so much of a challenging thing as taking the time to really think about what it is your nervous system needs, and knowing that.
Exactly.
I think the compromising part is easy. It was like the part that took longer for me personally was recognizing what the heck my nervous system needed.
Right. Right. It's like everybody's nervous system is different. And,
yeah.
And some are hyperactive. And, you know, we all eventually, like when I say to patients who are stressed out, like, let's figure out a way to put your brain like on a nice, comfortable raft that it could take a break, mm-hmm. that it feels like it's not hyperactive and firing, and having that understanding what your activity or what your special interest is to do mm-hmm. that. Like a sprained yeah. ankle, you want to be able to support your, like you would wrap an ACE wrap on an ankle, you know, when your brain is overstimulated, you want to find ways to mm-hmm. to calm that down. So yeah. I definitely get that, having that.
Calm that down. But then there are other needs too, besides rest, to be aware of, I think. I mean, generally speaking, autistic people have very strong social justice sensitivity and desire to advocate. And, you know, here I am, right, on a podcast. And so one need that I have is to be out there openly autistic, advocating and educating.
Absolutely. And that's...
And then my husband's been able to honor and accept that need too.
100%.
Yeah.
I mean, you're shifting cultural understanding and acceptance, and in being such a pillar in our community and society with the work that you do, you're basically like you're on fire with the movement here.
With your red hair, if you say so.
This girl is on fire, you know. And you have the red hair to prove it. So all right. So,
I have a shirt that says neurospicy.
Neurospicy. I love it. I love it. What, and we touched on this a little bit already, but I would like to just shine the light on this question a little bit more. But mm-hmm. what are some of the unique strengths or gifts women with autism actually bring to their families, workplaces, and communities? You touched on, you know, the open communication in your work environment and humility with just kind of seeing people the same, not really as influenced by social spheres.
Yeah. Yeah, those are some good examples. So some common autistic strengths are picking up on patterns, connecting information from disparate areas that others might not connect, and being very direct and open. So in psychiatry, being direct and open about socially taboo topics that others struggle to talk about is a strength. Mm-hmm. And many of these are strengths in some areas of life and not in others. That is less a strength than a, you know, medical society party get together. Much more of a strength than in my psychiatry practice, for example. You know, the monotropic, intense focus on an area of special interest is good for becoming an expert in that area. And some divergent creative thinking that brings novel things into the world, as well as our social justice sensitivity and recognition. We're kind of less influenced by social norms and focus on what is ethical instead of what is done as it's been done before. So autistic people tend to shake it up in social systems and point out inadequacies or inequalities, sometimes to their detriment, sometimes to the benefit of the system.
Mm-hmm.
And those are just a few autistic strengths.
In addition, you know, in sciences, and I mean, that could be just a myth, but the pattern recognition mm-hmm. and the complex thinking skills.
I think it can apply to any field. There, autistic brains tend to have what's called a spiky cognitive profile. So there's a lot of variety between individuals, okay? Mm-hmm. And within an individual, we tend to excel in a particular area and not excel as much in another area, a spiky cognitive profile. So let's say your verbal memory is extreme and your visual memory less so. So my brain, for example, my verbal memory is like way up there, but I don't recognize people's faces. And that is an uncommon in autism too. We call it prosopagnosia.
Okay.
It's mild at least. Ironically, with that spiky profile, I'll have like intense memory and understanding of what's going on with my patients verbally, but I'll walk out of my waiting room and I don't know which one is my patient.
Interesting.
And then they'll be like, what, Dr. Greeter, you don't remember me? And I'm like, I remember so many things about you. I just don't recognize your face. Right. And so that's hard to understand without understanding the spiky cognitive profile of autistic brains.
Sure. I can see it on a graph. You know, the spiky cognitive profile. I get that.
Yeah.
I get that. And maybe it's their voice or beginning to hear their story that kind of prompts that memory, not seeing their face. Yes, I get that.
Yeah, but like my office staff will put the chart under my door before I see the patient so I can look at their name and call their name in case I can't figure out which one is my patient.
Okay. Yep, that's perfect. And I think most people really, you know, appreciate that too. That definitely lends itself to confidentiality, you know, knowing the name, but nobody really.
It hasn't been appreciated much, I have to say.
In my experience, if I'm in a store somewhere, you know, and I see one of my patients, you know, it's never usually welcomed. I mean, we both kind of pretend.
No. I mean, patients like to talk to me outside the office and I'm fine with it, but mm-hmm. They'll be like, Dr. Greeter, you ignored me. I'm like, what? Where were you? I don't know where, you know, I'm like, and I'll tell them, I'm like, you got to say hi to me or I probably won't know who you are.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Unless you come say hi to me, you
right.
know, and introduce yourself. And depending on the patient, I've had some that I really was almost staring right through her. Like, are you not going to say hi to me? But she did not want to.
Yeah.
You know,
it's interesting. That hasn't really been my experience. That people are scared to talk to me out in the wild. People have been pretty friendly.
That's the way it should be.
Yeah.
Not being embarrassed of your mental health struggles or, you know, getting help.
I think it's
like
changing. I think we're having a shift. I think we're having a shift.
And it's, thank goodness, because I think, you know, I have a vivid memory of an elderly man who I treated for the first time mm-hmm. for his bipolar disorder that was close to 80 and had struggled with alcoholism most of his life, had had numerous jobs, mm-hmm. marriages, just a very, you know, difficult kind of life, you know, with his untreated bipolar disorder. And when we finally got him on the correct treatment, his kids and he said, you know, I finally feel comfortable in my own skin. I finally feel mm-hmm. normal. And it's sad to think that there are times that people just go through their whole lives just lacking that awareness or understanding, regardless of what their mental
yes.
health struggle
and
is.
And I guess I know clinicians and parents and et cetera who will avoid an autism diagnosis. And I want to encourage people that I personally found it to be one of the most positively life-changing and fulfilling things that has happened to me to have that self-understanding and greater self-compassion and self-awareness through an accurate diagnosis. I don't ever want us to withhold that from people.
Most definitely.
It doesn't make it not painful, but it is the gift of a more accurate self-understanding.
100%. That really, that understanding is mm-hmm. a staple and the foundation to anything and for anybody to pursue. And to not have that insight or that understanding and continue on and wonder, you know, try to compensate or mm-hmm. or self-shame or self-doubt
yes.
is a heavy lift.
I think younger generations are really coming a long way because I do child psychiatry too. So I'll go out, be an event or something, and a kid will come running, Dad, it's Dr. Greeter. And then they'll, hold on, I'm going to go get my friends. And then they come back with their friends. Hey, aww. This is Dr. Greeter. You know, meet my psychiatrist.
I know.
Right?
That's awesome. Yes, yes.
Yes.
That's the way it should be. Mm-hmm. 100%. That we need more awareness and more community support too. Mm-hmm. The way the system is now, it's like you've got to be really at the end of your rope and a danger to yourself or others to become, you know, hospitalized. I'd love to see more middle of the road community programs.
Yes, our health system is very reactive.
Yes.
And not as good at being proactive and sustaining health.
self-care is proactive, for sure. So what we already touched on, you know, how friends, family members, colleagues support women, the women in their lives, living autistic women in their lives.
I mean, I guess there's more on that. I think have curiosity first instead of assuming. Like, instead of assuming that someone is, I don't know, lazy or someone is rude, you know, have curiosity and approach that person and approach them as directly as possible is what I would say. I think that as clinicians, especially when a patient comes in and is like, I wonder if I'm autistic. And a lot of clinicians who don't see it might have a knee-jerk, like, no, you're not, right? Because they perceive the possibility of autism as really just being only a negative in that person's life, may dismiss it, not because they mean to be dismissive, but because they're being protective, you know? So I would say for family members and clinicians, if someone is wondering and curious about being autistic, to try to respond with curiosity, because our understanding of autism is growing so much and shifting and changing that we cannot assume, and we must be open to changes.
Have it as a working differential diagnosis, mm-hmm. and view it as a, have that curiosity as opposed to, like you said, dismissive.
Mm-hmm.
This can't be, you're not fitting exactly. That's why it's a spectrum. I mean, mm-hmm. there's many vast presentations, and that's in the best interest of whoever is being honest with you about that and you know, thinking about that and validating them. I think validation is really important, validating unique experiences.
Yes. I think the best thing we can do as clinicians, as parents, as loved ones, is to keep being curious and keep learning.
Yes, indeed. What are some resources or support networks that you can recommend to our listeners that are available for the adult population recently diagnosed?
Right, adult and child,
and
you know.
Yes.
So I love neurodivergentinsights.com. And she has a lot of workbooks, too, that are really cool and a lot of great articles. And she is on a podcast that's called Divergent Conversations. I think it's extremely powerful for a newly diagnosed autistic person to be able to listen to thriving autistic people talk about their experience and see one's experience reflected in another. So that's important. I like the Autistic Culture podcast with Matt Lowry is really fun. And Matt Lowry has a lot of good memes and visuals. As you talked about women in particular, there's the Autistic Women and Non-Binary Network. It's got some good intro packets on it for parents and caregivers, as well as patients and both children and adults. And I also really love the For Kids Embrace Autism, I think, presents it in a great kid-friendly way. And you can even take the RADSR assessment for free on there.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's great.
Yeah. For people who want a deeper dive, I love Is This Autism? A Guide for Clinicians and Everyone Else by Donna Henderson et al. It's a great book. And there's a companion guide for diagnosis for clinicians who want to beef up their ability to recognize autism, which I recommend.
Yes.
Because autistic people are all over.
Absolutely.
And
they come to us with cousins sometimes, like
depression
or OCD. Or
for physicians listening out there, I'm part of Autistic Doctors International, and that has been a really great resource for me. It's only open to physicians. There are many Facebook groups available for non-physicians. Yeah, like Autistic Connections. And then for therapists and other mental health clinicians, the Therapist Supporting Neurodiversity Facebook group.
Okay.
I've connected with a lot of autistic therapists there.
It's wonderful. There's the resources, the services are out there. The first step is self-awareness, correct diagnosis and then mm-hmm. incorporating the right treatment plan and lifestyle modifications and celebrating yes. your strengths. Mm-hmm. And you're a living testimony to that. So for people listening to, you know, some of these characteristics and they might be thinking to themselves, you know, maybe this is me, but, you know, they haven't actually gone out and discussed it with a clinician. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're a little bit reluctant. A safe space or, you know, a way to kind of yeah. pursue that. I think you've touched on here, you know, the questionnaire, the self-guided questionnaire.
Yeah,
that might...
I mean, it's hard. And there's a lot of talk about self-diagnosis, which is complicated. So I do believe that the most valid source of information regarding whether someone is autistic is the autistic person themselves and their internal experience. And so the diagnostic assessment really needs to focus on that person's internal experience. Of course, we have biases and there are downsides to self-diagnosis, right? But sadly, the state of access to good quality assessment for autism in adults is so poor that some people's best option is self-diagnosis versus, you know, going to an assessment and being dismissed and told they're not autistic, which could be extremely painful. And, you know,
right.
So
not giving credit to that experience.
Yes. Yes. So I'm throwing that out there, right? That is a struggle. Okay. So I would say step one, some of the resources I listed previously, learn about autism, see if it fits your experience of life, see what modifications you can make in your life to be more fulfilled, more functional, more connected to others. Find autistic people to connect to feel less alone. And be cautious and picky when selecting someone to do a neuropsychological assessment, which is extremely valuable when someone is educated on how to diagnose autism in an adult.
It would be great down the road if we had, you know, a fellowship specialty mm-hmm. that focused on this. And
yeah,
and
I know there are trainings. I know people can access trainings as clinicians on how to diagnose autism. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like I said, Donna Henderson's book is an extremely great resource too. And so their resources are there.
Right. And just kind of look at the big picture that taking that step, although it might be scary toward the self mm-hmm. reflection first and then seeking out resources yeah. and educating and empowering yourself with information, mm-hmm. you know, would really pay off tremendously by, mm-hmm. you know, improving your life in every aspect.
Yes.
And also just have you feel more comfortable, I think, in accepting of yourself and more empathetic.
And a lot of these autism groups and networks can direct you to people who provide neurodiversity affirming autism assessments.
This has been so helpful having you here today.
Well, thank you, Donna, for having me. I appreciate it. I always love to talk about autism.
Yes, I feel
and anything in psychiatry, let's be frank.
Right. And you know, I can relate. I love talking about mm-hmm. and promoting mental health and helping people feel a little bit lighter about life and mm-hmm. you know, it's not really a job for me, and I think we're both lucky in that respect. So your expertise and experiences have not only enriched our discussion, but of course provided such awesome information to our listeners. And obviously the DSM-5, which is the mm-hmm. Diagnostic Statistical Manual of all possible psychiatric diagnoses or personality disorders or struggles is huge, and that will lend itself the opportunity to invite you back. And I hope you'll come.
Oh, okay, sure. I'm happy to come back. I'm doing an ADHD presentation boot camp next. It's going to be space themed.
Oh, fun.
But it'll be well before it comes out because I got to get my other stuff done.
Okay. Have you been to Disney?
I'm presenting at International OCD Foundation. Too, so that'll be fun.
Really great yeah. stuff coming up. I would love to tap your brain and,
sure.
and discuss those topics as well. So, Dr. Stacey Greeter,
yes.
Thank you so much, and mm-hmm. We'll see you very soon. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in to the Brighten Up podcast today. And until next time, remember to live on the brighter side of life, like the sunflower who chooses to face the sun.